Yahweh will enter into judgment.
Dear brethren and sisters and our young people, at the end of that chapter 2, we had the circumstance of the earthquake brought to the attention of the people of Judah. Three times in ominous language, the people had been advised that such would be the judgment of God, that they would enter into the rock and hide them in the dust for fear of Yahweh and for the glory of His majesty. Again, that was reiterated in verse 19, and again in verse 21, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the top of the ragged rocks for fear of Yahweh and for the glory of His majesty when He ariseth to shake terribly the earth. In that day there would be no arrogance of man. The loftiness of man, verse 17, shall be bowed down. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down. And the haughtiness of men shall be made low. And Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day. And so the appeal that came, summarizing all of that ominous judgment, was in verse 22. Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? Those things formed a primary application. The greater application, of course, is to our own days, when there is a great earthquake portending, as God has spoken in Zechariah and in Ezekiel 38. When in the very same language as Isaiah chapter 2, which is firstly speaking of Isaiah's reign, and there is spoken of God arising to shake terribly the earth, when every high wall will be broken down, and all the works of man will come to ruin. Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? And now if we kind of omit that chapter break, we will see the greater significance of what follows. Cease ye from man? For behold, the Lord Yahweh of hosts, which has the sense of the mustering of his forces, doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water. They are the essentials of life, aren't they? Bread and water. What then is the stay of bread and the stay of water as far as the people were concerned? Well, the following verses indicate that, verses 2 and 3. The mighty man, the rich and the powerful man of the cities, and the man of war, whom they had depended upon to protect them from their neighbours. The judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50, the honourable man and the counsellor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator. They clearly are what the people saw as their stay of bread and their stay of water. But as verse 22 had said, they were going to cease from man. The mighty man, verse 2, and the man of war, verse 2. They were going to turn from them as they realized that all of that sophisticated aristocracy which had built up over the long and prosperous reign of King Uzziah, a fame which had brought national glory, where the fame of the king had spread right down unto Egypt, and there was no one that he feared. All of those great men that had built up during that period of time were going to be taken away, those upon which the nation had depended. In Psalm 146, David had so eloquently expressed where their trust should always lie. Psalm 146 and verse 3. put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. His breath goeth forth. It's almost exactly, isn't it, like the terms of Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 22. His breath goeth forth. He returneth to his earth. In that very day his thoughts perish. Happy is he that hath the God of Jacob, which was the subject of verse 2, for his help, whose hope is in Yahweh his God. And so there was an appeal to the people to look unto the God of Jacob, referred to in Isaiah 2 and verse 3. Isaiah, he was saying, and the people with him, there is no need for you to imitate, as it were, what Messiah will achieve. All of your building work, all of your great weaponry, will be insufficient in the day that God is bringing. He has all things in mind. He has his purpose in well programmed. He will bring that house of which he has spoken, and when it comes, it will eclipse all of your building and all of your might and all of your weapons. There is no need to try and imitate Messiah now, as though there were not prophecies about his future. Cease ye from man and from all those great men of the nation in whom you presently are putting your trust. You notice the depth of the society of Isaiah's time. Verses 2 and 3 indicate, don't they, that there was everything that they needed. There was riches in the mighty man. There was defense in the man of war. There was a courts of law, as indicated by the judge. There were prophets to give them a sanctimonious atmosphere for national occasions. There was prudent men, men known for their philosophy and learning. There was the elders that had been long time with the nation. There were the other officers of the army. There was the honourable man and the counsellor. There was the man who worked in materials, the cunning artificer, which I believe is the same group that I referred to, who in the days of Isaiah were responsible for those engines of war. Do you remember that in the Second of Chronicles? We'll just quickly look that up. Second of Chronicles, chapter 26, verse 15. He made in Jerusalem engines invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks, to shoot arrows and great stones withal, and his name spread abroad. That was not a little responsible for the fame of Hezekiah. They were inventions, things that shocked the world at that time. The cunning artificer in the Hebrew means someone who worked with materials, materials of any type. And then there was the eloquent orator, which is perhaps a rather exaggerated translation and has to do more with someone who was likely to be an incantor. That is, someone who was separating the whisperings. And the whisperings probably referred to a kind of muttered philosophies. And there were those who claimed they could discern and separate and understand all of that incantation that was in the nation. There was the work of mystery coming in. There were men who claimed they had secret knowledge. And so, turning from those things, God told them that they should be looking unto him. In the 50th chapter of Isaiah, there's a reference to the true stay of Israel. In the 50th of Isaiah, and in verse 10, who is among you that feareth Yahweh, that obeyeth the voice of his servant, that walketh in darkness and hath no light? Let him trust in the name of Yahweh and stay upon his God. That's our same word. And in essence, that's exactly what Isaiah in the earlier section is saying. When the mighty men, the counselors, the stay of staff of bread and the stay of water have gone, then when you've ceased from man, let you put your dependence upon Yahweh and stay upon Him. In the 55th chapter of Isaiah, there were other words that were tremendously relevant. These great men of the nation were seen as the stay and staff of life, where bread and water could be obtained. The necessities of life were dependent upon them, they thought. But in Isaiah chapter 55, there was a more superior bread, a waters not of present life, but waters of permanent life. Wherefore do ye spend money, verse 2, for that which is not bread, and your labour for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness, the prophet would say. Their true stay, it came from Yahweh, and it was not in bread or in water, but in bread and in wine, for which they should have to pay no price, but to diligently hearken unto their God. Now in the following verses, it says of those who were coming, and I will give the children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. That's in deliberate contrast to verses 2 and 3, where we had all kinds of aristocracy, including the ancient and honourable. I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. If you're going to put your trust in all these well-clothed and eminent men, then this is what is coming. I will take them away, that you might realise your necessity to depend upon me. The word babes is a very interesting word. It's derived probably from the word for gleaning grapes. And you know what the sense of the gleaning grapes was? It was just that which was left behind. When all the big bunches were taken and there was just something left behind, then that's what the poor had to be satisfied with. And that was what was going to happen in Israel. It's not the normal word for babes at all, and really I suppose you could say it's an awkward translation indeed. But the thought is this: there's going to come a time in Israel when you'll be going around like the poor and looking everywhere for just somebody to have rulership over you, because all of those that you put your trust in verses 2 and 3 are gone. And the people, verse 5, shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbour. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honourable. The honourable of verse 3, the ancient of verse 2. They have been taken over by another group of undeveloped, immature leaders of the nation. And so children became their princes, and gleaning grapes, the riffraff, if you might say, relating it to the society, riffraff shall rule over them. And the people shall be oppressed, every one by another. Now, Isaiah was in an entirely different position to this when the prophet spoke those words. Everything seemed to be clicking along beautifully. It was a well-ordered eminence and honourable society. But after him, of course, came a younger man, Jotham. Jotham had to reign because Uzziah was smitten by leprosy. And he came to reign, obviously, at a young age. It was indeed children to be princes, compared with what they had had before. But Jotham essentially did the right thing, didn't he, in his 17 years of reign. The grosser application of verses 4 and 5 is surely in the days of Ahaz, who was only 20 years of age when he came to learn. when he came to rule. No doubt when he did come to rule, he would have come with many of his own kind. For who would feel like being in the palace of Ahaz, of those ancient and honourable men who had been there in the bettered years of King Uzziah? They could hardly tolerate that upstart. They must have felt very much estranged by the wickedness of the king, by his deliberate seeking against that which his father for his better years had sought. So they would have retired into the recesses of the court and of the kingdom. And other men of the same kind of Ahaz, who could tolerate Ahaz, would have come to the fore, as David expresses it in the Psalms. When the wicked come to rule, then other wicked men come with them. And so there would have been a virtually new administration in the days of Ahaz. But who would you make to be an honourable minister in the days of Ahaz? Who could you choose from? There had been enormous numbers of people who had been lost to the kingdom of Judah. There had been, for example, 120,000 lost because of Pekah, the son of Remaliah. Before him, Assyria had come. Remember those five invasions in the days of Ahaz. The women and children, to the tune of 200,000, had been taken off to Samaria. Then the Edomites had come and they had taken captives, and the Philistines had come and they had taken captives, and Assyria had come and vexed him and not helped him. Where would you find people that could run the nation? You had to choose the riffraff. And when you chose them, they were men without dignity, without spiritual upbringing, and the nation would degenerate rapidly. There's a little proverb in Ecclesiastes which so perfectly fits the story. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 16 it says, "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning." You may say, well, there had been kings younger than Ahaz. That's quite true. There had been kings. Even Hezekiah was not that much older, 5 years older perhaps, when he came to reign. But you see, Ahaz was a child. When he had grown his full number of years, he was still an impetuous child. He was the type of person who never grew up. You remember how we referred to him before, that despite what God brought upon him, one judgment after another, from Syria to Israel, to the Edomites, to the Philistines, to Assyria, and through all of that, he refused to learn. That's always being a child, isn't it? An incorrigible child, that was Ahaz, that would never learn why things were coming upon him. There's a little proverb that I remember reading on a bus ticket once, and it said, "All men learn by their mistakes. Wise men learn by the mistakes of others." But Ahaz was so foolish, so baby-like, that he could not learn even from his own mistakes. He was the incorrigible one indeed. "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is immature." And that's what they had at that time. And it says, under this new administration that was to come, that they would despise the honourable and the ancient. You see, they wouldn't have had respect to those remnants of spirituality that were in the nation at that time. And so rather than listen to their advice, they were like that administration of Rehoboam. What do you think the ancient men did after Rehoboam chose the advice of the younger men?
Do you think that they still hung around the palace hoping that they might be used? They wouldn't have, would they? They would have gone away from the palace and thought, our wisdom, our years of experience are no longer required. And that happened in the days of Ahaz. What there was left of goodness and righteousness in the nation would have receded to the outskirts of the kingdom, for their advice and their experience was no longer needed. You know, in the law in Leviticus 19 and verse 32, it says this: thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honour the face of the old man and fear thy God, I am Yahweh. You have a good look at that verse, brethren and sisters. What's it saying? Thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honour the face of the old man and fear thy God, I am Yahweh. Is not that saying that in the old man there is a representative of Yahweh? It's not just that we have to respect age, is it? But that the old man, with his hoary head found in the way of righteousness, is closer unto God than we are as younger people. That's why he should be respected. There is an order. There is God, there is his Son Jesus Christ. There is man, there is old man and young man. There is woman. That's how Paul depicts it, isn't it? And if we're prepared to run past and over the old man and ignore his virtues and his experience and his wisdom, then in a sense we are ignoring Yahweh. That's what the passage is saying. You know, my dear brothers and sisters, I don't need to tell you that we are living in a world that totally disregards that principle. We have young people that will shoot past a group of older people right through the midst of them today. What do you do when that happens? Grab them. That's right. Take hold of them. So where do you think you're going? It's the best thing in the world for them. Have a little talk to them and make them to realize that principle. You see, that's what they do at school. They speak to their teacher by his first name. They have no blush to do that. We have our own young people down here. We can walk into that room and they'll be as noisy when you've walked in as they were before. In fact, on certain occasions, they've been a lot noisier, with all kinds of disrespectful noises, because the teachers come in. They are our children. It's wrong. It's fundamentally wrong. And it's not really up to the teachers to have to go into that room and to quiet those children each time. Every parent here should be taking that to heart. And they should get hold of those children at lunchtime today and say, what is happening with behaviour like that? It's very fundamentally wrong. But that's what happens in their classrooms. And that's the problem. But nevertheless, we ought to be aware of that and make our children individually realise that when that teacher comes in, they are there ready to start work. And they do not go on doing as though the teacher was not there. That's fundamental. And you know, that's just that kind of thing that rings right through Isaiah chapter 3. To grasp hold of proper principle and not to let it go, though we be in a flood of immorality today. It's just that challenge that comes out of this most remarkable Isaiah chapter 3. It says in verse 6 of the time that was coming, when a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, thou hast clothing. It was a rare thing to have decent clothes. Saying, thou hast clothing. That's the credential. Doesn't matter whether you're rich. Doesn't matter whether you've had experience. Doesn't matter whether you come from a family that might be able to offer some help in the circumstances of rulership. Doesn't matter whether you've had learning. You've got clothes on. You're good enough. Come on, let's have a ruler. Thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let this ruin be under thy hand. You know, you can feel the times of Ahaz behind that country. Come with me to the 2nd of Chronicles 28. It's a warning of that which was coming. The 2nd of Chronicles chapter 28. You can imagine them walking around the streets, all these very eminent men that they had in the land at that time, who were losing their sense of spiritual values, who were not holding on keenly to their relationship with Yahweh that had blessed that kingdom so greatly. This is what was coming. And in the 2nd of Chronicles 28 verse 19, a key phrase in the reign of Ahaz, for Yahweh brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he made Judah naked. Thou hast clothed, see the point, and transgressed sore against Yahweh. And that nakedness was never so poignantly seen as, say, in verse 15, when those captives, those 200,000 captives, were taken to the gates of Samaria, it says in verse 15, and with the spoil clothed all that were naked among them. Indeed they were naked. How poignantly it was seen when those 200 men, women and children, or rather women and sons and daughters, were by the gates of Samaria. And again in the 23rd verse, for he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus which smote him, and said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice to them that they may help me. There's something in the depths of pathetic nature about that. But they were the ruin, here's our word again, of him and of all Israel. Thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let this ruin, this mess that the nation has fallen into, be under thy hand. In other words, they desperately look around for anyone to take a public office, a position of responsibility, and give some rulership and guidance to the nation. But verse 7, they'd find it hard for anyone to accept the situation. In that day shall he reply, shall he swear, saying, I will not be a healer, a restorer, as someone to bind up the nation. For in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler of the people. For Jerusalem is ruined, and Judah is fallen, because their tongue and their doings are against Yahweh to provoke the eyes of his glory. For Jerusalem is ruined is the first note. For that's where the king was who caused the ruin of the whole of that nation. Ahaz. Because of Ahaz, king of Judah, who caused that ruin. In the first chapter, verses 5 and 6, the nation was spoken of there earlier, wasn't it, as being sick. Why should you be stricken anymore? The word used of leprosy. You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. They desperately needed a healer. From the sole of the foot even unto the head there is no soundness but wounds and bruises. That's why they needed someone to bind them up, as that word healer means. Putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Right in the very beginning, just to remind us of that passage in Deuteronomy chapter 32, God had said that when they were brought low, he would be their healer. Deuteronomy 32.
Verse 36, for Yahweh shall judge his people. Yahweh shall judge his people. Cease ye from man, in other words, whose breath is in his nostrils. Yahweh shall judge his people and repent himself for his servants when he seeth that their power is gone and there is none shut up or left. And he shall say, where are their gods, their rock in whom they trusted, which did eat the fat of their sacrifices and drink the wine of their drink offerings? And let them rise up and help you and be your protection. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. But when God brought that stroke upon him time and time again, what did he do? He turned to the foolish gods of Assyria again. An incorrigible man. The depth of that unteachableness is quite unique in all the history of the nation. And so they are in desperate need of a ruler. Does that remind you of a passage, my dear brothers and sisters? It says, just picking up the words of verse 7 again, speaking of the insufficiency of this person that might be asked to rule, he said, I will not be a healer, a binder, for in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Neither bread. It's a very interesting little echo, isn't it? That the first king they had came from the house of bread, from Bethlehem. That's where their rulers had come from. It was always the requirement of the king, wasn't it, that he should be able to administer, to bring bread and happiness to the people. And in Micah chapter 5, the contemporary prophet, there was that very beautiful statement. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, house of bread, of fruitfulness, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. There was a ruler appointed, one who had both house of bread and clothing of righteousness. But in the insufficiency of the people, the nation had fallen into ruin. And in these subsequent verses, he speaks of the present arrogancy of the nation. And this is why they would fall into the situation of verses 6 to 8. Perhaps just a reference, firstly, though, to verse 8. In the latter part of that verse, Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings are against Yahweh to provoke the eyes of his glory. Aren't they tangible expressions, my dear brothers and sisters? To provoke the eyes of his glory. Their tongue and their doings are against Yahweh. See how they use their tongue in verse 9? They declare their sin as Sodom. There was no shame left in them. Do you know, I see that in our society every day, don't you? In our papers, what they will write. Our society is exactly the same. There is no shame. Do you know our young people are like that? The other day, somebody came in and spoke to them about the need not for boys to go into girls' rooms at night or vice versa. And that I saw two or three of our young men despise the person who spoke to them. Despise the person. If you want to know who it was, I'll tell you later if it's your son. Because it's important to know, isn't it? But that's the hardness of our children sometimes. We've got to get through to them, my dear brethren and sisters, my dear parents. We cannot take that laxly. We've got to get through to their hearts. And if we see those things, we've got to work on that carefully and thoughtfully, but persistently, until we break through and create in them a sensitivity to God, or they're gone. We cannot go into the kingdom with haughty looks. Look at the obvious nature of the request. But there was a very intense despisement that somebody should dare to say such things to them, or what was wrong with it anyway. It's a little frightening. It's not the general group, of course. But it is a great worry, and we see that in young people wherever we go. That's what's happening to them at school. They are unashamed of sin, unashamed of evil, because it's so much part of their world. And if they get a taste of it, their faces become sullen, and they wear it outwardly as it is within. Let us, as we read these things, take them to heart for my children and for your children, lest reading them we make the same mistakes as Judah and cannot respond. And it says that they provoked the eyes of his glory. His glory was found, of course, in the tabernacle, wasn't it? The Shekinah glory. They provoked the eyes of his glory. When did that happen? Above all other times, I mean. Why, surely it was in the days of Uzziah, wasn't himself? The king that did so much good, and then because when his heart was lifted up in his strength, he entered in defiantly into the holy place with incense. And the eyes of Yahweh were resting over that place as they always were. It was alongside his glory. And that king had a hard face that was prepared to go right up to the incense, the altar of incense, which was just before the veil of the Most Holy. And Yahweh was watching that whole event. And it was like a symbol of the nation. Their doings against Yahweh to provoke the eyes of his glory. And it did provoke him, didn't it? And he struck him with leprosy. And in the following verses we have echoes again of those circumstances. The show of their countenance doth witness against them. The show of their countenance. The fact was, of course, with the king, that when he came forth from the tabernacle, his countenance did declare his position, didn't it? What God did with Uzziah was show on the outside what was really on the inside. The corruptness revealed to the nation that in fact the king through pride had been utterly corrupted. It's a great tragedy. The show of their countenance doth witness against them. And the king, now ashamed before his people, ran away and found a separate house and dwelt there. But throughout the nation, there were hard faces. They were unresponsive to the words of the prophet. You know, my dear brothers and sisters, I was listening to that previous session like most of you this morning. And it really was a very moving part of God's word, wasn't it? Absolutely moving. Wonderful and remarkable. And the graciousness of God, that because a king turned to him with his heart, he would not only be prepared to save Hezekiah and his family, nor Judah, steeped in wickedness as they were, but he would turn the hearts even of the men in Israel to come and have another chance again. Isn't that wonderful? Absolutely wonderful. But then not only that, but he would extend even to those who had already gone into Assyria. Isn't that absolutely magnificent? Hezekiah was not working alone, was he? It says several times in that record of the graciousness of God that he was going out to prepare the hearts of that people. There was a cooperation from heaven above in ways unseen and unknown. You can't help but see that. It is God that worketh in you both to will and to do of his good will. It's not our own work. It's a false teaching that says that. God is working with us. Working with our hearts. If we will but turn. What a gracious God that was. And that was soon coming to this nation, this same nation. But what a suppleness we need to have in respect to our Heavenly Father's work in our midst. unless we get like verse 9. But I'm frightened by verse 9 because sometimes I see my children come to the breakfast table. Instead of having happy faces, there's a sort of dullness there, and I want to light it up. There can be a self-content sometimes, can't there? A walking about the house only concerned about themselves. It's the age of self-concern. And yet there's a thousand things to be done, all kinds of things, all over the place. And even here, the young people that have got blessed circumstances have got all kinds of opportunities of those that come from country areas, those that have got single parents, those that have left, those others that are back still at home that probably are missing their company. Have they dropped them a few lines like they should? Have they concerned themselves about them in prayer? We've really got to bring these issues to our children, lest a generation arise that show on their faces that they're hardly moved. Nice, clean, open children. Children that can respond to the things of God. Teach them, my dear brethren and sisters, that it is well worth to serve Yahweh. Say to the righteous that it shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. They shall eat the fruit of their doings. That's the emphasis of the prophet. Woe unto the wicked, it shall be ill with him. You'll get what you sow. For the reward of his house shall be given him. It is not a vain thing, said Moses as he spoke to the people in the beginning, to serve Yahweh. It's not a vain thing. It is your life. He will not forget you if you do the right thing. But if you continue that way, then you'll get the reward of your own hands, as says the prophet. And as we, my dear brothers and sisters, see our own children arising, let us take that to heart. What Israel lacked was elders who were prepared to name the issues and stand by them. What is our own ecclesia like in these regards? Have we got young people coming up who are prepared to openly challenge the elders of our meetings? Is that good? It's never good. And it doesn't even matter if what the young person is saying has a margin of truth in what they're saying. It's not the right thing. For when they are elders, will they want the young speaking up and dishonouring the old, the ancient and honourable? Of course they won't. Is that right? No. What does the Leviticus say? It says clearly that they should honour the older person. Ecclesias cannot function like that. Our children cannot be dictating the policies of our ecclesias and what we should be doing. It's an impossibility if good decorum and preservation of our meetings is to be seen. There was a special indictment, verses 12 to 15, upon the elders. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err. They which lead thee mislead thee, says the Hebrew, and destroy the way of thy paths. Yahweh standeth up to plead and standeth to judge the people. In the absence of them bringing proper judgment into the ecclesia of God, God says, I will stand up. And he stood up in the case of all those that came in the days of Ahaz, and later on in the case of Assyria when he came right over Judah. Yahweh will enter into judgment with the ancients of the people and the princes thereof. For ye have eaten up the vineyard, the spoil of the poor is in your houses. In other words, when there were great needs, concerns all over Judah, the people were going off and doing what they wanted to do when they wanted to. They bought their boats. They bought their tennis equipment. They had all the gear of recreation. And they just went off and did it when they liked. If they had a weekend away, well, so what? Ecclesia got a special on? If not, well, so what? This just happens to be a weekend. I want to be away. And so they went and did all the things they wanted to do when they liked, how they liked. They weren't going to be restrained by the causes of Israel, by the needs of Judah. You know, somebody said to me that if you're sick today, you can be sick alone. Your family might come. I've heard of that kind of thing overseas. But I never thought it would be among our ecclesias. A lack of thoughtfulness and care, of taking into our own hearts the anxieties of other people. I wonder how many letters of concern and interest have gone from the Bible school to people in need? Or do we pick up the phone? Or have we even done that? Because we can't leave our responsibilities, can we? And the busyness of commercial life today saps out the ability, in so many cases, to really concentrate upon the things of God. The record goes on to speak, doesn't it, of the women who were absolutely gone crazy about fashions and about everything they could put in any possible place, whether their lips or their nose or their ears or anywhere else or their ankles, just like our stupid world. There was a time a woman might have a brooch. Today she's got 6 bangles and 6 rings and things dripping around from her face in all different directions. Why? Don't bring that in here, my dear brothers and sisters. Don't take it to your pleasures. See where it's going. Leave it out. That's what the Apostle Paul said in the clearest terms. They were signs of affluence and of uncaring nature of the women. And so rather than be concerned about all those things that were in the ecclesia, and our ecclesias are full of such things, look about your meeting. Haven't you got single people bringing up groups of children in your ecclesia? Of course you have, so have we. Aren't there some of those children that are in desperate need? Indeed there are. When do we bend over those children at some time to have a little talk with them, to enter into their lives? There are great numbers of causes that reflect that the same problems of the latter-day generation that Isaiah was experiencing are upon us now. Let us take it to heart. Cease ye from man, and let us put our trust and stay in the God of Israel. In verse 12, as for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. What I think happens is this. When a society becomes wealthy, with the passing of years, the men of that nation become soft. The British Empire would be a classic example thereof. There were great men in all of the first part of this century. England had so many of them, she could send administrators all around the world. But now, Mrs. Thatcher is the greatest man in the British cabinet. That is to say, she has more of the qualities of fortitude and conviction than any other person. Why otherwise, when all of those learned men from Eton sat around that cabinet room on the first time, did they elect a woman? Because there was a lack of leadership among them. Believing something, where they came from. She was in that position. And so she has come forth to fill a vacuum. That's what I think has happened. In the verses 16 to 26, which make Max Factor blush, something. Is that his name? Or is it Max Fatchin? I'm never really sure. He's the humorist, isn't he? That list of all the things that were being worn by the woman, there again is another feature of an indulged society. That's exactly what we are seeing in our society.